Yes, I am going to talk about that. I'm not as quick thinking or responsive as Charles, so I'm not going to have any bits about Brexit at all. I'm going to stick to this deceptively simple question. Would land sharing or land sparing allow more wild species to survive? And I plan to address this question, first of all, by explaining what those terms land sparing and land sharing mean. I'll then describe a model that allows the question to be addressed quantitatively. Then I'll tell you about some field studies designed to answer the question. The results I'll present are actually strikingly uniform and seem to answer it quite unambiguously, but actually the measurements leave out some things that we should really have included. So I'll also be describing a bit more work that remains to be done, which we hope to do. And finally, I'll ask if either land sharing or land sparing are actually feasible to deliver through policies and activities of farmers and citizens on the ground. So first of all, I need to say that this is the stuff I'm going to tell you about. The research I'm going to tell you about is the work of a large group of people, not just at Cambridge, although as you see, quite a lot of them are, co-led by Andrew Barmford here and myself. I'm going to, in defining what the talk is about and what the question is about, I'm going to start off by saying what it isn't about, not because this thing isn't important, but because it is necessary to be clear. Demand side, that is how much agricultural produce we Homo sapiens actually decide we need to produce, is very important, and I'm not denying that. But this question is about something different, which is, having decided how much we want to produce, how do we produce it? Do we produce it by high-yield farming, a lot of stuff per unit area of the farmed landscapes on the planet, or do we produce it by low-yield farming, much less stuff, or something in between? This other question, how much do we need, is very important, and other people will talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it except to say, does the answer to this question, how much stuff do we need to produce, affect my question, how best is it to produce it? And I'll come back to that, I hope. So here's my question. It's this: would it be better for biodiversity, which I mean the aggregate of wild species on the planet, if production in farmed landscapes was relatively low, allowing them to be benign for wildlife? And that could sometimes mean that actually quite a large proportion of the landscape was in little bits of woodland or bush or small wetlands like ponds and so on. Would that be good? Seems it must be, because then surely more wild species, insects, birds and so on, could actually live in the farmed landscape. Or alternatively, might it be better for wild species, for their populations as a whole, if actually production in farmed landscapes was quite high, a lot of stuff being produced per unit area of the farmed landscape, actually maybe with not much room for wild species in the farmed landscape, but if you used the fact that you are producing your requirement of agricultural goods in a relatively small area, if you then reserved or indeed restored areas to natural habitats elsewhere, would the benefit from that to wild species counteract the fact that the farmed landscapes themselves weren't actually terrific or indeed any good at all for biodiversity? So that's the question. So we came up, in 2005, we came up with a simple model which didn't answer the question, but was intended to instruct us about some things you could measure that might be able to answer it. And it's this trade-off model, which is the basis of the terms land sharing and land sparing. So which is better for, consider a single wild species, consider, say, a block of land, at least a kilometer, square kilometer, maybe more, and the population density of a single wild species on that block of land. Which is better for that species? Is it better to have high-yielding farming, which occupies the minimum area possible, or low-yielding farming, which might, if at its lowest, occupy the whole of the region, because you need that to produce whatever it is your production target is, how much agricultural goods you want to produce. So to answer that question, you need the thing that's on the graph, a density yield curve, which is a plot of population density of this species against how much agricultural goods are being produced per unit area of the farm landscape. And that's that blue curve. Suppose this is a real species, and that's what you get when you actually find out the answer. So the vertical line there, which is where that circle is what we call the production target. It's how much stuff you want to produce. If you move to the right, you're producing more. If you move to the left, you're producing less. So it turns out that if you draw the chord between zero yield and one on relative population density and that vertical line, you get essentially an index of the total population of the species in both the farmed areas and the spared unfarmed areas. And so it's easy to see that for this species, that second point I've just put up is lower than the first point. And that means that for this species, it would do best in terms of its total population size in the whole region if you grew the agricultural produce in the at the lowest possible yield that will allow your production target to be met. So for this species, land sharing, low yielding agriculture and land sharing is best. For this other species, we do the same operation. You see the second point in this case comes up higher than the first, and that tells us that the total population size of this species will be higher if you grow your production target of agricultural goods at the highest possible yield that you can manage. So for this species, land sparing, high yield farming and land sparing is best in terms of total population size. So the principle now is if it was possible to go and do that for a lot of different species, ideally all the species that live in a particular region, then you could do some vote counting if you like. Oh no, shouldn't have said that, should I? You could do some vote counting and classify species in this kind of way. So the color codes are important because I'm going to come back to them in a minute, so try to remember them. First of all, there are losers and winners. Losers are species that do worse with agriculture in the world than they would if there was no agriculture in the world. And they have curves that go down. Population density goes down as you increase farming yield. As we've just seen, there are two kinds of losers, well, more than two actually, but two main kinds. Losers that like land sharing, low yield and land sharing, which have that shape of curve in the blue box, and losers that do better with land sparing and high yield, which are the ones in the red box. There are some intermediates with humpy shaped curves, and my color code for those, which you'll see later, is going to be purple, intermediate between the two. And then there are winners that have a variety of shapes of curve, but what they have in common is they are better off with agriculture in the world than they are without it. And I'm coding those green. Okay, so that's just a theoretical model. It doesn't tell us anything about what the answer might be. It just tells us that we could, in theory, go out and collect data about the real world and draw those curves and try to answer it for a set of species. You can't do it for all species, but you could do it for a sample of species, maybe. So that has been done, and it's now been done in seven different studies on five continents, but the first two attempts to do it were by two PhD students of mine, Ben Phelan, shown here in Ghana, and Malvika Onial, shown here, who did her work in the Terai region of northern India. And what they did was to go out and sample 1 kilometer squared areas across a whole spectrum from unfarmed natural habitats like forest, right the way through to the highest level of farming intensity that they could find, production per unit area, and measure populations of some wild species and also, very importantly, lots of biologists go out and measure population densities of wild species in different kinds of farmland and natural habitats. What they don't usually do is go out and measure agricultural yields in the same places. And what Ben and Malvika did was to go and do that as well, by interviewing farmers, by getting data on crop yields from their fields and so on, and put together this information on yield. And they got the yield both in terms of food energy per unit area of the farmed landscape, and also in terms of financial return, gross margin, taking into account the inputs and the prices obtained for commodities. And they published, the work of their work was published in 2011, and in some ways the results were quite surprising. You can see Malvika is looking particularly surprised by her results, but I think quite a few people were surprised. To some extent I was too. So here's just their two study areas. Now, here's where the color coding comes into play, folks. So I'm just going to explain this once, because we haven't got time for me to tell you the message from all the slides I'm going to show you. Quick fire next. So the color coding, remember, is blue for a loser that likes low yielding and land sharing. Red is a loser species that likes high yielding, land sparing. Purple is intermediate, something in between the two. And green is a winner. And I'm not splitting winners into different kinds because they're all better off with agriculture in the world. And as a quick fix, I'm going to say, well, those are species perhaps that people interested in biodiversity conservation might not worry about as much as the losers. So we're just having one category of winners. And so the interesting question from the point of view of my answering my question in the beginning of the talk is how big the red bar is relative to the blue bar. Now, what we have here is results from birds in Ghana and India, and they're split into two types, ones with large global ranges and ones with small global ranges. And the reason for doing that is, of course, the ones with small global ranges are likely to be the ones, well, they're more likely to be endangered now, and they are more likely to, I would argue, to be endangered in the future. So what do we see from this? We see that the red bars are bigger than the blue bars, which means more species do better with high-yielding land sparing than lower-yielding land sharing. This is at the production target, the amount being produced in India, in the regions, in Ghana and India, at the time these studies were done. And then there are also quite a lot of winner species, but notice that when you add up the blue, purple, and red, in all cases, there are more losers than winners. So more species that are, if you like, threatened by agriculture in these regions than like it. So that's the results for the birds. One very striking thing you see that overall there's more species that would do better with high-yielding land sparing than land sharing among the losers, but that tendency is greater for the small global range species that I would argue are more likely to be threatened in the future than it is for the species with larger global ranges. And also, the ratio of losers to winners is more biased towards losers for those small range species too. Okay, so that's the message from that one, and I'm just not going to explain all that ever again. All I'm going to do now is take you quickly through some other kinds of creatures, and then some other places, okay? So do your own work and extract your own messages from these reds and blues and greens, okay? So here's the same result in Ghana and India, but this time for trees. Notice quite a similar pattern. Here's the same result for, Malvika is the only person who could survey butterflies properly out of our team. So we have butterflies only for northern India. Here's a result for butterflies. That's most of their results. But of course, that's just two places. Since Ben and Malvika finished, we've had collaborators, students, and so on working in these other parts of the world. And those parts of the world have got all kinds of interesting contrasts with Ghana and India. Some of them are in different biomes, like where the natural vegetation is grassland rather than forest. Some have had lots of agriculture in the past, which may have reduced or been maintained. Some of them have been glaciated or had other climatic fluctuations. And some have had used to have lots of big browsing, grazing mammals and have lost them because Homo sapiens came in and killed them. So there are some interesting contrasts there. So the question then is, do all those patterns of blues and reds and greens change drastically because we've now done these studies in some different areas? And the answer is, I'll just go through quickly with these. These are some results for Uganda and the Pampas on the border of Brazil and Uruguay. This is for birds. Again, large global range on the left, small global range on the right. If you look, you see the general patterns that are described for Ben and Malvika's work in Ghana and India are maintained in these four birds in these study areas. Here are birds, and this time not splitting, just to cut the number of graphs, not splitting into large and small range species. But here's all birds, the same results for a study area in Mexico and in the Yucatan Peninsula, and a study on the steppes of Central Asia in Kazakhstan. This is birds. And here we have some non-birds, more non-birds. We've had trees before, but here's trees in Mexico, trees in Poland, dung beetles in Mexico, and sedges in Poland. The same kind of pattern is emerging, I hope you can see, from all these diagrams. And then we have similar findings as well, which I don't have time to show you, for dung beetles, asters, and grasses in the Pampas. I come back now to my demand thing that I started with. And I want to ask the question, does it matter that, does the level of demand, how much you want to produce from a region in terms of agricultural produce, affect the answer to my central question? So this has been done by Claire Feniuk, who's in the audience, I think, from her study in Poland, where she's rerun the calculations, assuming that, first of all, considerably more agricultural produce would come out of her region in northeast Poland than comes out now. And she's also done it if there were to be considerably less. So her less is to cap per capita consumption and the population in Poland and have that not have any effect on production, but to assume that food waste was cut in half, which results in a considerable reduction in how much stuff you need to produce. So here's the result for birds that you saw already. Same coding of colors. That's for things as they are now. This is for the increased production scenario, and this is for the decreased production scenario. And all the color coding and everything is the same. The main point here is the demand scenario doesn't do much, except that at higher demand, the advantage for wild species of high yield sparing over low yield sharing becomes more pronounced. Proportion of winners and losers doesn't change. Okay, that's the end of me showing you what the data seems to say about my question. I said we couldn't answer the question definitively because of various things we hadn't taken into account yet, and this meshes onto Charles's talk about sustainable intensification. Is it an oxymoron? So what we think is important to this calculus to do with biodiversity are external environment effects of how the farming is done, by which I mean things like atmospheric and waterborne nutrient and pesticide pollution, unsustainable water use affecting systems outside the farmed landscape, greenhouse gas emissions and soil loss also affecting systems outside the farmed landscape. And we haven't quantified these things yet, and they need to be taken into account in the calculus. If high-yield farming always has to, do great harm to ecosystems outside the farmed landscape, then that's bad, and it needs to be taken into account in this simplistic calculus I've been describing to you. So our objective here is, first of all, to try and quantify those things, and to identify the ideal things for sustainable intensification, which are high-yield farming systems with low external environmental effects. And we plan to try and build in that into our sparing-sharing system by estimating the abatement costs for these external negative environmental effects and taking them into account in the analysis. Finally, this is the last point. can land sparing or land sharing actually be realised on the ground? We know more about land sharing because for many years under the Common Agricultural Policy in the European Union, rest in peace, we've been trying to implement land sharing by paying farmers part of their subsidy going to trying to preserve good features of the habitat for wild species. We know it works sometimes, we know quite a lot of other times it doesn't work very well, or at least it's not very good value for money. So there's a mixed picture on that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But people have thought relatively little about how land sparing can be implemented. Now, sparing involves linking high-yield farming to preservation of natural, or creation or restoration of natural habitats, which is a harder thing to do than persuading a farmer to keep a few fields, a few hedges or ponds or small woodlots on his farm, or change the amount of fertilizer he applies or the amount of pesticide he applies. All that is under his control. For land sparing to work, you have to get some farmers over here to do something, and you have to get in some other place some protection linked to that of natural habitats or restoration of natural habitats. We know that market effects alone don't do that themselves. If you just have higher yield farming, you might get a little bit of land sparing, but not very much. So what else is there? Well, there are possibly market-based incentives like eco-certification. So here's a little map that you can imagine this as a sort of shade coffee on the left and sun coffee on the right, but with the person whose coffee estate this is saying, I'm going to preserve half of my estate as natural forests. At the moment, the left-hand one would be called eco-friendly and the right-hand one wouldn't. But maybe it should. You'd have to do the calculus and see what came out best for biodiversity. Command and control, so this is governments saying in this region we're going to permit and encourage high yielding farming in this, but linked with that, farmers, you've got to stay out of these other areas. Similar kind of government encouraged systems through subsidies and payments for ecosystem services. And finally, strategic deployment of investments through where, for example, new road systems or irrigation systems, extension officers, agricultural extension officers, are deployed by governments, by aid agencies, by overseas aid, and so on, that can influence the relative pattern of intensity and methods of farming in different areas. So here are my conclusions. Our field studies have indicated that most species of wild plants and animals in the areas we've looked at, the seven areas we've looked at, would do better with high-yielding agriculture if it could be linked with preservation or restoration of natural habitats at a given fixed level of agricultural total production. Land sparing is potentially the most beneficial for the restricted range wild species that are most likely to become threatened in future or are already threatened. We found that the level of demand, while very important, doesn't affect the answer to this part of the equation about the impact of agriculture on biodiversity. The relative benefits of sparing and sharing are, in all the places we looked at, not just that Polish case, not much affected by the production target. We haven't allowed for the abatement costs for negative environmental effects of different farming systems. In fact, at the moment, we don't even know whether the kind of obvious thing that the amount of negative external effect per unit product, which is the important thing, from high-yield farming and low-yield farming are the way around that everybody might think, i.e. worse for high-yield farming. That quantification needs to be done much better than anybody's done it at the moment, I would argue. And finally, the potential benefits of land sparing are really entirely theoretical at the moment. More work is needed to identify and also to test possible policy mechanisms that are capable of realizing them. Thank you.
Thanks, Rhys. as with the first speaker, if people have questions for Rhys, please direct them to him. There's a hand immediately in the middle.
Hello, yes. Is that working? Duncan Catchpole from Cambridge Sustainable Food. When you were sort of giving your graphs about the data collection, one thing that was going through my mind was, and it might sound like a stupid question, I might have missed out on something big, but natural selection. It struck me that, you know, there are quite a lot of green winners, which you said you weren't sort of particularly interested in that particular data, but that got me thinking that, you know, if you're surveying an area and there's sort of largely agricultural sort of land use in that area that you're surveying, then of course you're going to find sort of a lot of winners there, because, you know, the theory of natural selection means that they will be the species that thrive in that area. So to my mind, that sort of put a question mark over kind of everything, really, but I might have missed out on something earlier on.
Yeah, I'm not sure maybe I didn't describe the scenario very well, but we're talking here about a large region like southern Ghana, and we're saying for the total populations of the species that live there, or it could be southern England for that matter, what will be the total population sizes of a whole range of wild species, hundreds in the cases of these studies, of doing the farming in different ways. So the species, this isn't affected only by whether there are lots of species that like farming. It's also affected by whether there are lots of species that don't like farming, but like natural woodlands or wetlands or grasslands, okay? So I kind of missed the point of your question as regards natural selection and so on. That seems to be not to come into it.
The point was, you know, in any area, if you go and survey the sort of different species there, they're going to be species that are suited to the area that's being surveyed. Hence, you've got sort of a decent number of winners in those particular categories, you know, the green ones, because, you know, they are, you've gone into a farming environment and, well, you know, lo and behold, you've found a load of species there that are suited to that environment.
Yeah, but the whole point of the green bars and the red bars and the blue bars is there are different numbers of species that fall into the category you're describing, and the other categories, the ones that don't like that kind of farmed environment very much. And that's the whole point of the argument. And I'm still not really getting your point, and maybe we can talk about it.
I'm going to encourage this conversation over coffee, if we can, please. There's a question here with the microphone already. I've seen one hand here and a second there, so we're going to have those two next. But
sure, Simon. Thank you. Thanks for the talk, really enjoyed that. Simon Atwood, Biodiversity International, again. I'm wondering if I guess this is as you start to move the whole land sparing, land sharing beyond the theoretical enclave, which it's sort of been dealing with for a while, and into more the implementation side of things. I'm trying to imagine how it would be enacted in certain landscapes around the world I've worked in. And particularly in regard to the fact that agriculture is an highly productive agriculture, particularly that gives high yields, is not randomly arrayed in the landscape. So certain landforms and certain vegetation types that would have been on those landforms or currently are on them, so grasslands, open woodlands, that kind of thing, would be preferentially cleared as they are, and you can see that pattern in any kind of, you know, altitudinal gradient around the world that's got human influence. So under a land-sparing approach, would you not, unless you had the additional legislation around protecting certain elements, you have a representative system like they have supposedly in Australia about different vegetation types, unless you couple it with that, it could actually drive highly preferential clearing of highly productive, low-lying, flat landform systems with deep soils, that kind of thing. And therefore, you're losing whole swathes of biodiversity, even though your absolute numbers of biodiversity might actually be retained.
Okay, I think there are two things to say about that very good point. One is, in the studies that were done, as far as we could, we matched things like topography, climate, soils. So we were, you know, and the main reason for the land cover in those, in the different study places being different within a region was that, you know, one was maybe further from a market or from a road or whatever. You can't do that perfectly, but we did it as far as possible. But you're quite right, the places that have been cleared for agriculture are, on average, often very different from the ones that have survived, which are on the tops of mountains or whatever. It wasn't as extreme as that in our case, and we tried to fix that. But the other part of the response to your very good question is that in practice, any on-the-ground implementation of a land-sparing strategy would require, as a first step, some kind of scenario for land use, where all the points you made about, well, you know, for example, where do you put the if you're going to spare or restore some natural habitat, do you do it on the least agriculturally productive land? Do you do it next to any existing protected areas, which is often kind of the same thing, actually, and so on. And this is what we call land use scenarios, and all the seven studies that I described have done that in addition to describing the funny little curves and so on. So that is a very important step, and that's the kind of thing where the people who've done this have mostly tried to do it in collaboration with local agronomists and farmers groups and so on, to see, and also conservation NGOs, to see what kind of pattern of land use would actually be realizable on the ground. When you do those scenarios, the conclusions you come to about what proportion of species would do better with high-yielding farming and low-yielding farming come out more or less the same, as you might expect. But you're quite right, you do need to take the practicality of doing it and what would be the best places to spare, both in terms from the farmer's point of view of not losing too much agricultural production, and also what the wild species would benefit most from. Thank you.
So I have two questions in the middle and then one where the mic is.
Hi, yeah, Olivia Maas from the Animal Health Trust. I was just wondering, even though, you know, there was quite a lot of different studies in a lot of different countries sort of bearing out similar patterns, you're saying, like, well, we need more data, and also, like, how would this actually transform into policy? In the meantime, as someone trying to be an ethical consumer, would be better off buying normal, highly intensely produced products or organic products? Like, what can we do in the meantime?
Hold that thought, and I'm going to take the other two questions. If you could just get the mic over here, and then I'll come to you in the end.
Hi there, Humphrey Crick from Natural England. It follows on from the modelling question which you've answered just before, which is, so as the mix of purple, there's these purple and blue species, and you really need to identify a mix. You need to sort of model the landscape, don't you, I think, to work out the appropriate mix to optimise over all those species, unless some of the blue species also are red species. And I was wondering how you also match this with the fact that 25 of the world's, I think it's 25 main crops, aren't there, in the world, which people eat. Some of them won't be suitable for land sharing, I guess, and you really have to grow them intensively. So then there'll be some modelling to do to take that sort of thing into account. Is that a sort of approach which you might take?
Okay, and I think one last question, I'm afraid, before we... Yes.
Thank you. Sarah Parks, CGIAR. I'm interested in looking at this concept of land sparing and sharing through the eyes of dietary diversity and nutrition. And what I've seen you produce is that relationship, which is about production, I'm assuming yield per acre or whatever. And I wanted to recognise that sustainable intensification in its definition by people like Lewis is far, far broader than production. So I wanted to put to you the idea of the work that you're doing in the context of increasing dietary diversity and nutrition.
Thank you. As quick as you can.
Right. First of all, I'll do them in order, if my brain can cope with that. should you buy intensively produced food or not as an environmental option? I would say at the moment, not without knowing some more about how it was produced and whether it's producing lots of pollution, affecting ecosystems away from where it was produced. The kind of intensively produced food I would consider is, you remember I gave the example at the end, if somebody's saying they've got eco-friendly coffee because they've got an estate growing coffee and half of it is a beautiful reserve of natural forest which is protected in perpetuity, and the other half they're making their money by growing the coffee as intensively as possible, as long as they're not polluting the environment with pesticides and so on, I would say that's, if you look into the facts of that and it comes out like I've just said, that would be probably a good option. So second question, Humphrey's question about mixtures of things, and I think, Humphrey, the main answer to that is like the answer to the gentleman over there, that in terms of on-the-ground implementation of anything, you wouldn't just look at a load of fitted statistical curves, you'd actually have to create these scenarios and say, well, what could we grow there and what couldn't we grow there, and how fast would habitats be recovered in this place compared to that place? I kind of think that partly answered your question. And then the third one about the details, the composition of the diet and all those things, I think the answer is a bit similar, really. We've tried to do some of we've done our calculations in terms of food energy per unit area of the farm landscape and, you know, net dollars or pounds or what euros per unit area of the farm landscape. That's far too simple. We've tried doing it in terms of protein and some nutrients as well. But when you're doing that, of course, because you have to eat a mixed and balanced diet, it becomes the sort of thing that you can only do through complicated scenario building, drawing some simple curves and colouring things in red, blue, purple and orange and green won't work. So that's why we didn't talk about any of that. But I quite agree, one must do that.
Rhys, thank you. I'm aware that I didn't allow you to ask your question. If you can find Rhys during coffee, then that might be a good way to follow up. Sorry.